Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a podcast about the rulers of the ancient Roman Empire. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me as always is Dr. Rhiannon Evans, a lecturer in ancient Mediterranean studies at La Trobe University. This is episode LVI, May His Bones Rot. In 132 CE, Hadrian faced a revolt from Judea, with political and religious tension causing the Jews to rise up against him. Faced with losing a province and facing his own empire, Hadrian's actions will greatly influence the course of Jewish history. That's a nice way of putting it. Now for the not-so-nice, here's Rhiannon Evans.
Back in 70 CE, Vespasian and his son Titus had destroyed a lot of the city of Jerusalem, including really important sections of it like the temple and the archive. And of course, Titus had then had a magnificent triumph. The Arch of Titus had been built in commemoration of that to celebrate this Roman victory. So the city was in a certain amount of disarray and probably hadn't been completely rebuilt at the time of a revolt under the Emperor Trajan. So coming now into the second century, towards the end of Trajan's reign, when he's really trying to sort out what he would regard as the eastern part of his empire, and he's building on it, enlarging it. But much of this is spoiled by local revolts, and one of those local revolts is in Judea and was put down in 117 by Trajan right at the end of his life as part of his attempt to really maintain his recent gains and avoid complete dissolution of the Eastern Empire. But I guess things are left fairly unsettled in that region in general when Hadrian comes to power.
So it sounds like, in some respects, there would have just been an endless trail of conflict from go to woe. So this is inevitable almost that Hadrian would have to deal with this.
Yes, especially because it happened right at the end of Trajan's life. There's a good reason for thinking that he can't deal with this decisively from the point of view of the Romans. And yeah, there is constantly a sort of bubbling under of tension in this region. It's exacerbated by the Jews' monotheism, which is always going to have some kind of conflict with the Roman pantheon. And once you start deifying emperors, even more so. So along with the pantheon, the polytheism that the Romans already have, they have many gods and they don't see them as being in conflict with one another. Many more than we know of, actually. Lots of much smaller gods other than the Olympians. This is a problem with a religion that only has one god and won't acknowledge any of the others. And it comes into conflict with political structures and political frameworks when some of the gods are previous emperors. And that has an ongoing effect on the current emperor, who derives some of his authority and power from the fact that he has ancestors who've been deified. So it's not surprising that these two worldviews could not see eye to eye. For Hadrian, it may be that he is there at the moment when it really comes to a head. And of course, his motivations are quite difficult to judge apart from this ongoing tension that I've spoken about. But he does seem to have been an emperor, as far as we can tell, who has a philosophy of fixing the boundaries of the empire. So we've talked about that before in terms of building Hadrian's Wall and kind of solidifying the boundaries of empire in Africa and in Germany. And this is a kind of ongoing conflict that doesn't allow that to happen. So he's not particularly interested, as we've seen, and he actually gets criticized for it by some later sources, extending the boundaries of empire. But he wants what he has to be solid. This area is one of the areas that's stopping that from happening.
So the first time that he visits the area, sometime during his prolonged travels, he issues a number of edicts that, while can be explained in some aspects, can also be seen as religious persecution, depending on how you want to interpret it, can't they?
Yeah, they certainly seem quite tyrannical, especially by our standards. The most famous one, I suppose, is that Hadrian bans circumcision, which is a really important part of Jewish ritual. There is actually some discussion about whether he bans this outright or he bans it only for small infants. I guess either way, the Jews regard this as persecution, as preventing them from carrying out a central part of their religion. This has the effect, basically, of not allowing them to practice their religion. So that is something that's taken very hard by the local community, and that's not very surprising. He also rebuilds the city of Jerusalem, which sounds like a good thing, but he basically rebuilds it as a Roman city and renames it. There's a lot of renaming in the Roman Empire, and Hadrian rebuilds it and gives it his own name, Aelia Capitolina. His middle name, his family name is Aelius. And he doesn't allow Jews into it. He basically uses it as a place to put his veterans. It's very common for, back from the Republican period, for military commanders to use new cities in the provinces as places for their veterans, as a colony. But usually it is brand new. It's a brand new city, and some people think usually built on a Roman fort, and that's why Roman towns have all those straight intersecting roads, because that was the shape of the original fort that was there, and then you turn that into a town once you've conquered the region. But of course, this is a very ancient city that he's doing that to, so it's not like taking what might have been open ground, it might have been populated, but not as a kind of permanent settlement. So this is quite different and is something that really frustrates the Jews from inhabiting a region that's important to them.
This is on what the Jews saw as their sacred land. By doing this, he's essentially kicking them off it, and he bans them from entering as well, doesn't he?
Yes, and I suppose that it's quite surprising that a Roman doesn't understand how important the land is, because that's the way the Romans would have regarded their city. Even though there have been lots of changes through the Roman imperial period, and you can see power shifting to other places, the city itself is still sacred to them. It's still got a sacred boundary. Of course, it's kind of the heart of their religion and worship and political centres. But this is not something that Hadrian seems to take into account when he builds this spanking new city on the site of Jerusalem.
So at this point, having rebuilt the city, Hadrian leaves for a while and continues on his travels, leaving in command the local governor, Tinius Rufus. Just a slightly unfortunate name there. And this is 132 CE. So you've essentially left behind an ant's nest that you've kicked.
Yeah, a fractious population, to say the least now.
Yeah. So what happens at this point?
Well, a variety of things, which we have mostly Greco-Roman sources for, although there are some others which come from the local community too, sometime later. We have a huge insurrection against Rome by the Jewish population in 132 CE. Now, Dio gives us an interesting perspective on this. He says that there was an omen that when the tomb of Solomon collapsed, the Messiah was about to arrive. And of course, one of the central tenets of Jewish religion is that the Messiah will come. And this had happened in 132, according to Dio. This signal had kind of stirred up the population and led to the rise of a man who takes on the name Simon Bar Kokhba and leads this very bloody uprising, which lasts for years. And he seems to have used this opportunity, or seen this opportunity of the signal that the Messiah was coming, to take this narrative on himself, because the name Simon Bar Kokhba that he took on means the son of the star. By the way, my pronunciation of Jewish names might not be quite as good as my pronunciation of Roman names. Mm. I apologize there. It seems like he was accepted by some authority figures as the Messiah, but not by others. Certainly, Christian sources are all very negative, because they think that he persecuted Christians at the time who thought they had already had their Messiah. So there's a lot of tension here between communities. Mm. But of course, even if people did believe he was the Messiah, or even if they didn't believe he was the Messiah, they're already in a state where Hadrian has left lots of fuel for them to burn in terms of their anger. So it's not surprising that they fix onto Bar Kokhba and that there isn't a huge uprising at this point.
Mm. And the regime that Hadrian has left in place, Tinius Rufus, he's also actively persecuting the Jews as well, which kind of done a good thing to the reputation that Hadrian leaves behind.
No, I mean, it's as if they've set up the perfect conditions for this to explode in the Romans' faces.
Hmm.
It's quite surprising, because in many ways, Hadrian is much more of a conciliatory figure in lots of areas, but not here, not at all. I think that if you were a diplomat, you would say that Hadrian had messed up this situation badly.
So the Jews are hoping to rise up and have an effect against the might of the Roman Empire. Did they have any realistic chances in this at all?
Sure they did. The Romans are a very powerful military machine, and once they start to concentrate those forces with legions, then of course they're hard to beat on in open territory. But the Bar Kokhba uprising, the Jews use very clever tactics, which is more or less guerrilla warfare, so hit and run tactics. They know the territory, they know the landscape, so they can hide in the mountains. This really is, I would guess, the only way to beat the Romans, unless you have a mighty army of your own, is to use a completely different form of warfare, which they're not accustomed to and which they're kind of not trained for. They're trained to be out on a battlefield. So this has a lot of success, and there's a lot of Roman casualties because of this form of warfare.
So what was Hadrian's response to this kind of uprising? Because he's not really... Well, emperors are never the most tolerant kind of people when you try and fight against them.
Well, he almost certainly came back to the area. There is actually some scholarly debate about whether he did or not, but it all comes down to, yes, he must have, because of the language used, in that he's there to give awards out when soldiers do good things and that kind of thing. There's no one that specifically says Hadrian came back and took charge of the situation. He almost certainly did come back. He was in Greece at the time. Surprise, surprise, Hadrian's in Greece. And he also sent a really important governor over there, so a really important military leader, a man called Sextus Julius Severus, who was at that time governor of Britain, which many people have seen as a demotion, being moved from Britain out to Judea. I don't know what the relative statuses of the provinces were at that point. Certainly, it's a more dangerous position, but of course, if you can win that war, then you will be given many prizes.
I think Severus needs to take it as, this is a bad situation and you're the most reliable person to deal with it.
Exactly.
Not a demotion, man. Nothing like a demotion.
He has to take it as a compliment. And he's given a lot of manpower to deal with this. So Hadrian moves 3 legions and 17 auxiliary units into the area. There's talk of there actually being a shortage of soldiers because of this. So they're actually starting to recruit often quite young men around the empire to try and make up this shortage in legions around the empire. So they take it very seriously, and it has serious repercussions. Interestingly, Anthony Burley, who is perhaps the scholar on Hadrian, he theorizes that Trajan's architect, Apollodorus of Damascus, whom we're going to talk about elsewhere and I know you love, that he might have been called in to design the siege works.
Okay.
Now, Burley himself says this is speculation, but he has reason for this speculation, because Apollodorus is attributed with a literary work, or a technical work, I guess you'd say, a book, which is on siege works. Now, Burley doesn't think this is all his own work. He thinks it was added to later, but the fact that it has his name affixed to it might mean that he has some experience with having to build armaments for warfare, and that he might have been there, which is interesting and would mean that Hadrian had had to kind of, you know, swallow his pride and try and get on with someone that he didn't otherwise get on with.
Yes, well, we'll get back to that in the next podcast. Okay, so at this point you've got Severus in charge of a large amount of troops in Judea, fighting against people who are more experienced on the terrain, in mountainous terrain where you can't get a good formation together. What tactics does he employ?
He does the typically Roman thing, which is he realizes he's got to learn from his enemy. You do see this happening over and over again. It must be one of the reasons that the Romans are so successful militarily. They don't just stick to one tactic. They are quite flexible. And Severus is one of these generals who sees very clearly that he needs to change tack. So he adopts the enemy's own tactics against them. He knows where they're going for their food. He finds this out. He gets this information, knows where their supplies are, their farms, and he cuts them off from that. So he's sending kind of small squadrons of troops out. It's not so much that he really needs the huge legions. They're not in open battle. But he knows that he's got to send small numbers of troops to certain places, and he prevents them from getting these supplies, and he basically starves them out. But it's a war of attrition.
Yeah.
It takes a long time because, of course, they're not all in the same place. All of the Jewish rebels, they're moving around. They're very flexible themselves. You're not going to catch all of them at any particular time or in one particular place. So that's one of the reasons that this lasts. It's a 3-year war of attrition.
Wow, that's a long time to be hiding out in the mountains and fighting and just...
Yeah, I mean, it shows a lot of dedication, you could say, from the very least.
And neither side would see them as having any other choice but to continue this until the end.
Absolutely. And actually, neither side really, when it comes down to it, will see this as a very clear victory, even though, to give away the end, the Romans will be victorious. It's not one of Hadrian's high points.
Yeah.
This is not something where you can say, oh, you know, we beat them in open battle. It's much messier than that for the Romans.
So what do we know about the end of this conflict then?
They eventually come down to one major site called Betar, which is a place that they can lay siege to, which is something the Romans are much more comfortable with.
Mm.
They've got, you know, centuries of siege warfare under their belt. They know what kind of tactics to use. My pronunciation might not be great, but the Arabic phrase for this place is Kirbet al-Yahud, which means the ruin of the Jews. So it's a place name that's very much related to the event that happened there, and it's this event.
Mm.
It's a very, very bloody and long-lived siege, though. It's a 3.5-year siege.
Just for this one place.
I mean, no siege is nice. You're basically trying to starve people to death or into submission. But this seems to have attracted the notice of people like Dio, who talk about it as being one of the nastiest, bloodiest sieges on record. So Hadrian wouldn't let the Jews bury their dead. Sometimes in warfare and siege situations, you at least give them a truce so that the dead can be buried, and then you go back to the hammer and tongs warfare. But no, they weren't allowed to do that, which again, for, not just for the Jews, for most people is something that's quite offensive to them religiously and in terms of their family traditions. And of course, that kind of thing also spreads disease.
Yeah.
That would make the whole thing even more difficult. The Romans are really cruel, even for the Romans. There's a Jewish source that tells us that the Romans killed until their horses were submerged in blood to their nostrils. And that the fields didn't have to be fertilized for years because there was so much blood in the fields.
Poetic license aside, though, Dio gives us some actual numbers on the outcome.
He does.
Of it, doesn't he?
He does. And look, these ones may be more believable than most ancient historians' catalogues of numbers, because we always treat them with a bit of suspicion. But Dio says that in the overall war, which, remember, goes on for 3 or 4 years, over 500,000 Jews were killed. He gives the number of 580,000. 50 towns, which were fortified, and 985, so nearly 1,000 villages, were completely destroyed.
Mm.
So that's a huge number of lives ruined, because apart from the killed, there would also be casualties, and then there'd be orphans and people who can't go back to their town because it's not there anymore. And we know that a huge number of them were also taken captive, because Dio also tells us that the price of Jewish slaves fell dramatically, that the market was flooded, basically. There were so many slaves coming out of Judea, so many people taken captive after the war. He specifically says that they're worth less than some animals to buy.
Mm.
So this is really a destruction of physical buildings and towns, but also of a whole society, really.
Well, Hadrian was pretty determined for this not to be a problem after this, doesn't he?
Yes. The province which had been Judea doesn't really exist anymore. It's renamed, although probably after Hadrian's death, renamed Syria Palestina. So that gives us the name Palestine. And we don't really have something that can be called any kind of Jewish state until 1948. So 1800 years of kind of getting rid of this particular nationality. It's slightly anachronistic to use those terms about antiquity. But, you know, you don't have any formal state, even a province.
Mm.
I'm not sure Hadrian could have known that it would have such a long-lasting dramatic effect.
But it did give him a reputation, I suppose, if not in the area, then definitely throughout the empire. This is the defining military.
Well, you've got to wonder if he's not doing that thing of making an example of a people so that nobody else would dare to do it, because I think that would have been quite effective. Hadrian then has a reputation with Jews as being a real kind of destructive force, and somebody who they continue to curse. So there are marginalia, Jewish writers who, every time Hadrian is mentioned, will write, may his bones rot or may his bones turn to dust. So his reputation kind of continues through the centuries and continues to be somebody who is, diabolical in their eyes. So maybe you could align him with somebody we would think of generally as bad, like some of the Roman emperors, like Nero, or like Attila the Hun as a destructive force who comes through Europe. That's what he is for them historically.
To slightly defend Hadrian, though, what he did isn't hugely different from how the Romans dealt with the Carthaginians or how Trajan dealt with the Dacians. This kind of response, this kind of reaction has come all throughout Roman history, hasn't it?
I think the Dacians are a good parallel there in that they were driven out of their land and they probably ceased to exist as a society. And indeed, because they, I don't want to use the word effective because it's such a negative thing, but they less effectively managed to retain their culture in any way, that they just kind of disappeared.
Mm.
Whereas Jews did manage to retain their culture and their religion. So there's a difference there. But as I say, the Dacians are a good parallel. And particularly, I always think of the very last image on Trajan's column, where they're just being driven out of their land. And at the end, it's just people, cattle, and then sheep just wandering off their land. So the last small creature is driven out. And yeah, they were completely got rid of. The place is then recreated as a Roman province. You have veterans settled there. It's pretty much exactly the same process, but less well remembered because the Dacians were destroyed as a society.
That's Dr. Rhiannon Evans, lecturer in Ancient Mediterranean Studies at La Trobe University, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe to it on iTunes. And reviews and telling your friends about it are appreciated. You can give this podcast a like on Facebook, and you can follow both of us on Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans, and I'm at Nightlight Guy. In the next episode of Emperors of Rome, Hadrian struggles with succession and legacy. But until then, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.